for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Every 2016 presidential candidate is likely to have the support of a super PAC. A super PAC can raise unlimited amounts of money from businesses, groups, and individuals, and can spend this money pretty much any way it chooses, as long as the candidate is not directly involved. Here to talk about what many see as an expanded role for super PACs in the 2016 presidential race, Mattea Gold of the Washington Post, Derek Willis of the New York Times, and Jan Baron and Kenneth Gross. They're both attorneys specializing in election law. I know many of you have strong feelings about PACs and money in the campaigns. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow at wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for being here.
Great to be here, Diane.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Nice to see you all. Mattea Gold. PACs, these super PACs, first came onto the political scene back in 2010. Give us an idea how they got started.
Sure. So super PACs are essentially a creation of the Supreme Court's Citizen United decision in 2010. And that decision said that corporations and unions can independently spend unlimited sums on political activity. A few months later, another federal court issued a decision that effectively created super PACs, which are political committees that can accept these large contributions banded together, and they can spend their money directly on campaigns as long as, you mentioned, they don't coordinate directly with the candidate that they are supporting. And we saw them really come into fruition in the 2010 congressional elections. In every cycle since, there's been a proliferation of the use of these vehicles to do political activity. And now heading into the early 2016 presidential election activity, we're seeing these groups really take center stage. They are driving the action of what the would-be contenders are doing right now. Their focus now is raising money into these groups that can accept unlimited sums before they even start their official campaigns.
So tell me how they were used in the 2012 presidential campaign.
Well, Mitt Romney, who was the Republican presidential nominee, was a lot faster to embrace a super PAC, and some of his allies set up one very early in the process. That group was the most successful super PAC of the cycle and raised tens of millions of dollars. President Obama had a real distaste for this kind of fundraising and spending and really discouraged his supporters from embracing it until finally he was persuaded by his strategist that they would be left behind if they didn't start using this as a weapon in campaigns.
And I gather it was a total of some $2 billion that were raised.
Well, there was $1 billion spent by independently in that cycle, and so a large amount was on the presidential campaign. And I think that we are on track, obviously, to see unprecedented spending by these groups in this cycle.
And to you, Derek Willis, an AP story yesterday by Thomas Beaumont wrote that it looks like Jeb Bush may be using super PACs in new ways. Explain that.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story, and we should probably begin by saying there's a lot we don't know in terms of exactly what a super PAC related to Jeb Bush would be doing in a prospective presidential campaign. As Mattea points out, he's not officially a candidate yet. But the gist of the story is that it's a departure, a potential departure from what super PACs have sort of been traditionally used for in presidential races. About 97% of the money that the Mitt Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future, spent in 2012 was on television and radio advertising. And so this story, and depending on sort of what the plans are for this super PAC for Jeb Bush, the ideas being discussed include things like having the super PAC have a role in the management of campaign data that is important not only in advertising, but also in voter turnout, in the messaging that gets sent out, and how that happens, but also perhaps even, you know, using or having the super PAC play a role in voter contact itself. I mean, what those things do, those offloading of certain very, you know, traditional campaign activities, what they do is they would give, in theory, a presidential candidate sort of more time away from fundraising, the individual dinner events with high-dollar donors.
Spending on the hours on the telephone.
On the phone at these events. And you can, if you look at the 2012 campaign, you can sort of understand why that would be appealing, because two-thirds of the money that Mr. Romney raised was from people who gave him at least $1,000 or more. And in order to do that, you have to make a lot of phone calls and you have to do a lot of dinners and lunches and breakfasts. And that's time that a candidate could arguably be doing something else, maybe even meeting with voters.
So to you, Jan Baron, these are the kinds of advantages that these super PACs would give to candidates. Less time on the phone, offloading some of the responsibilities they would otherwise take on.
It does, and what we are, I think, are witnessing is a dislocation in the campaign finance system. And while super PACs are relatively new, and what they are doing is relatively new, actually what they are doing highly resembles what the political parties did until a law was passed in 2002, which prohibited them from collecting and spending money in unlimited amounts, even from corporations and unions. That became illegal, and they can't do it today. So the only sources, the major sources by which that type of fundraising can occur is through super PACs. They have to do it a little differently than the political parties did, because back before the reforms, the parties could bring in the candidate to a big fundraising event and raise that money as well as other money. The candidates, on the other hand, today are limited to raising no more than $2,700 from any individual per election. So that is time-consuming, as Derek noted. It's also very difficult to accumulate the funding necessary for a major presidential campaign, although it can be done. President Obama demonstrated that in his reelection campaign. He had 200 fundraising events, many of them here in D.C. during rush hour, many of us recall, where he would have dinner with perhaps 40 or 50 donors and collect not only that $2,500 or $2,600, but also $30,000 or $40,000 that could go to the Democratic Party.
So all in all, you see this new role for super PACs as a good thing?
Oh, it's an inevitable thing. I do think it's positive in the sense that it does allow for more campaigning and electioneering, although I don't think anyone, any Republican or Democrat or observer would say this is an ideal system. I mean, this is a screwed-up system. We would all agree on that. I think the problem is, what would we do to fix it, and how can we fix it?
First, to you, Kenneth Gross, what do you think of this new role for super PACs?
Now, I don't like them. I think they're turning the campaign finance system on its ear. The story about Jeb Bush, I was going to say the tail is wagging the dog. The super PAC, the independent committee, is going to be spending perhaps more money than the campaign, although I'm not sure which is the dog or which is the tail. You know, the political party committees have a role in the general election, but now it's become a phenomena of determining who the nominees are in these super PACs in the primary election. And you can lose Iowa, you can lose New Hampshire, you can lose South Carolina. Ordinarily, your campaign would be gone by then because you didn't show enough support, can't raise enough money, and millionaire, billionaire, whoever can step in, put $100 million, $10 million into some super PAC and keep your campaign afloat, as we saw in the 2012 election. And a lot of these super PACs are funded by a handful of people. They are not representative of the support of broad contributions from donors.
However, according to the Supreme Court, they are, number one, legal, and number two, simply perhaps a natural progression that we've seen.
Well, I don't know that I would characterize it as a natural progression. It is legal. Five of the nine justices said it was okay. Four of them said it was okay before Justice Sandra Day O'Connor left the court. So one justice caused the shift in the determination. And they are certainly legal as long as they don't coordinate with the candidate, which could be a fact-sensitive determination. We'll see how that plays out.
Kenneth Gross, he's an attorney specializing in political law. He's former associate general counsel at the Federal Election Commission. Short break here. Your calls, your comments when we come back. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. From Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
And as we spend this hour talking about the new operations of super PACs, how much money they can raise, key question comes to the word coordination. Tell me about coordination and prohibition or relaxation against prohibition, Matea.
Sure. I think this is a really important point because often the public hears the word coordination, that there's no coordination involved or allowed, and they think there's a thick, impenetrable wall between the candidate and the super PAC. In fact, that the federal regulations are drawn very narrowly, and that what is really banned is conveying private strategic information from the campaign to an outside group that then uses that in an expenditure. And so that leaves a lot of room. The FEC has actually blessed candidates going to super PAC fundraisers and participating in the fundraisers for those organizations as long as they technically don't ask for more than $5,000, which is the cap on traditional PACs. So that has led to what is a fascinating sort of delay in the announcement of official 2016 candidacies this cycle. We've seen Governor Bush and others go around the country, talk about their plans for the future in America, do very aggressive fundraising for super PACs without declaring their candidacy because they have more leeway to engage in fundraisers and actually even ask for more than $5,000.
Derek.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence that you've seen the official announcements from people who are currently federal office holders, from Ted Cruz, from Marco Rubio, from Rand Paul, because they can't do some of the things as federal elected officials that former governors, former or even current governors might be able to do under federal law. And I think the really interesting thing about what Matteo was saying was this idea of private information, private campaign information being shared.
Give me an example.
So let's say your campaign does a poll internally, then you couldn't, for example, turn around and hand that internal poll directly over to your super PAC and say, you might want to know about this, and here's where we are weak on certain issues.
And here's where you need to go after more money.
But, for example, like one of the other things, offshoots, and this is from reporting that Matteo and her colleagues at the Washington Post have done, is that there's a nonprofit group also, a political nonprofit organization that is in sort of the Jeb Bush orbit, if you will, that is ostensibly will operate as a policy shop, issuing papers and things like that. And what they could do, one way of operating that, is to operate it completely in the open in the sense that they would release these policy papers that they publish publicly. And then that removes sort of this question of private communication entirely. And so, in theory, other candidates could take their policy papers, but it would seem a little awkward and unusual for that to happen. But that one act of sort of acting in public can help mitigate the legal risks of that involved in coordination.
Yeah, as far as coordination is concerned, it is a porous concept. On the fundraising side, you can coordinate, as Matteo indicated. And on the expenditure side, it's not a difficult process to send smoke signals up to let your super PAC know where it's going.
Give me an example of a smoke signal.
Well, you can literally tweet or in other social media communications can say, we're in a desperate situation in a particular jurisdiction. There's where the TV money and radio money goes immediately. There are other methods of communicating, and that's the legal methods of communicating. Who really is going to be standing over people to have a conversation? A one word, two words may be enough to get the word out. And we don't have an aggressive regulator here in the Federal Election Commission. There are fundamental differences between the Republicans and the Democrats on that commission as to what actually coordination is. And the likelihood of an investigation into this is not very great. And even if it did, it would take forever to get it done.
These are not smoke signals. These are bright neon signs. What we're talking about is the dissemination of publicly available information. A candidate can take a poll and then post it on his or her website, and that becomes public information. The same is true of any thing like videos. Candidates post video of themselves on the web, on YouTube. And anyone can download it and use it in their commercials, which are independent expenditures under the law. Our complaints, by and large, are the fact that public information can be used by these people who are spending money outside of the campaign. And in terms of collaboration with the campaign, it's unnecessary for them to be secret about it because they can partake or distribute so much information publicly. In the rare occasions in which there is evidence of such secret collaboration has led to a criminal prosecution in the last couple of months, where a campaign manager for a congressional campaign in Virginia was involved personally, was setting up a PAC, soliciting the money, directing how it should be spent. That's a crime. And the Justice Department investigated and prosecuted that person.
Mattea.
Yeah, and I agree with Jan. I mean, I think the point is that so much of this can be done in a very legal, kosher fashion. To me, the one of the most telling examples was in the 2014 congressional election, when in one of the final weeks of the race, we saw the campaign of Tom Tillis, who was running for senator in North Carolina, issue an email to all the supporters who had signed up for emails on their website. I believe the email memo title, the title was Media Strategy, and it detailed all of the ad buys and all the different markets that the campaign had, where they thought they were weak, and where it would be really great to have some extra help to boost the points in that market. And they argued, you know, this was just a message for supporters who care about our strategy. It also gave a direct signal to the super PACs about where to increase their television
and
buy.
And your paper probably wrote about it,
we
right?
We did.
Yeah, so there's a lot of dissemination of publicly available information.
Kent, you want to add to that?
I do, because I think this sort of the fact that we're having a serious discussion about this demonstrates what a farce the system is. The system was set up to reduce the influence of individuals over candidates, derogation of the common good and all this. Now you're want to give $1 million, you want to give several million dollars to a PAC. Do you think there's going to be no appreciation by that donor, by the candidate, considering what's going on and the ease in which there is involved in coordination and know what's going on? It shows a devolution of the entire process.
Derek, do we know so far how much money has gone into the 2016 presidential campaign?
We don't, for the most part. Only one candidate, Ted Cruz, has actually filed a report from his campaign. That was on April 15th. It was about $4 million because it represented about 8 days of formal campaign fundraising activity. There was also a filing from Ben Carson, who has an exploratory committee. Again, not a ton of money in that one as well. Most of the campaigns that at least exist now, but also more importantly, I think, for our discussion and for possibly the election, the super PACs will begin filing in July. July 15th will probably be the first filing for most of them. Mm-hmm. And there will be a couple other organizations that will also file other reports around about the same time. And so that will be our first glimpse. We do know that, you know, people occasionally will put out, you know, numbers about pledges and particular events. We know, as Mattea said, that Jeb Bush has been very busy. He's certainly not the only person who's been very busy. There are at least four super PACs that are involved with Ted Cruz's candidacy. And from, you know, what we know about that, we know there's at least pledges of at least $30 million involved in with at least one of those committees.
Mattea.
To me, the figures that tell you all you need to know about money in 2016 right now are 15 and 4. 15 is the number of candidates who have sanctioned super PACs being run by their allies or their friends. 4 is the number of candidates who have actually declared. Their emphasis right now is raising big money, and that tells you where the action is right now in the election.
And what we've been talking about so far is disclosed money. We haven't even talked about the nonprofits of undisclosed money, the 501c4s. You see the spending of it ultimately, but we don't even know the source of that money, and that's more tens of millions of dollars.
So how easy is it to find out who the donors are to a super PAC?
You can, super PACs are reporting, so we do know the donors to super PACs.
Very easy.
Yeah, it's on the internet. There's a lag in the timing of it, but you can look that up without difficulty. And because of that, there is an appeal of the 501c4 organizations. A donor comes along and says, look, I don't want it out there that I'm giving $10 million to Ted Cruz or to Jeb Bush or to Hillary Clinton. I just don't want it out there. Don't worry, we got a separate account for that, where the money's not disclosed.
Derek.
What we have is we have a system in which there are now like multiple vehicles that sort of meet both the donor preferences and also the campaign or candidate preferences for types of money and types of spending. And so now instead of saying to a donor who was a really committed supporter, you can really only give me $2,700 per election, you know, you can make it clear to that person, or that person can find out for themselves, that there are other vehicles, other organizations that would be just as useful to the support of that candidate.
Now, Mattei, it was reported recently that a growing number of these super PACs are controlled by one person or one family. What are the numbers, and does it matter?
Well, we don't have any specific data yet because most of these groups aren't disclosing until July. I do think that a lot of the candidate-specific super PACs are going to have enormous number of donors, many of them incredibly wealthy. There was some reporting that these separate, four separate super PACs set up for Ted Cruz were sort of each the purview of a different family. What's so interesting now is that donors have become incredibly savvy about how these super PACs work, and they've also sought to have a lot more control about how their money is spent. A lot of conservative donors in 2012 felt that they poured tens of millions of dollars into efforts to elect Mitt Romney unsuccessfully. Now people say, you know, I want my money specifically go to the digital media strategy, or I would like my funding to go to a get-out-the-vote effort. And a lot of these donors sort of fancy themselves political strategists and have learned about how the system works.
And can they legally do that, or can they say and have that carried out?
Oh, sure. I mean, the super PACs that are happy to get their money are, I think, very willing to have them direct their funds into the activities that they support the most.
But that's where the candidates lose control of their campaigns. Now you've got super PAC donors controlling the message to some degree. Because they don't want
bad?
To turn down that money. Yeah, I think it's a bad thing.
Why? Because
we elect
control everything?
The candidate, we should know what the candidate's positions are. They should be controlling the message. That's who we're voting for. We're not voting for a billionaire donor giving to a super PAC, dictating how the money should be spent, not only method-wise, but substance-wise.
You have an alternative feeling about that,
Jan. Well, I don't think the candidates can or should control what Derek and Mattei write in the paper. Why should they control what anybody else says or does if they want to convey their own messages? I just don't think that's a healthy process. What we're regretting here is that the system, in my opinion, has prevented people who would otherwise like to support the candidate directly may not do so. It cannot support the party directly, except under very artificial and very low limits. So when they've given their $2,700 to a candidate, whether it's Hillary or Jeb Bush or Mr. Cruz, that's it. If they want to spend another nickel, they can't do it with the candidate. They've got to go somewhere else. So what are their alternatives?
Congress just raised the limit to $800,000 for an individual to give to their favorite party committee.
Well, I think that's a very serious alternative, and it ought to be considered. In fact, what has happened in some of the states as a result of the system being all out of whack is that the states are revising their contribution limits. They're reforming the law in order to allow people to give more money to the candidates and to political parties. Isn't that better, where we would have more transparency and the candidates would have the resources necessary to run campaigns?
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How do you respond to that, Ken Gross?
The limits currently are high enough to accommodate virtually every donor that I know of. There aren't that many people who want to give $100,000 or $200,000. We're talking about a very limited group of people. If you want to support your candidate for president, yes, the limit is $2,700, which is not an insignificant amount of money, but they have joint fundraisers where the money can go to other political committees. At least this is going to something that's under the control of the candidate and not some sphere of a $10 million or $100 million contribution.
All right. Mattei, I want to ask you, because you recently wrote about Bob Menendez and how he got in trouble about super PAC donors.
Right. What was so interesting in that case, in which we should note that there's been charges filed, but nothing's been proven yet, but the allegations include that a donor who was hoping to curry favor with Senator Menendez gave him substantial funds not only to his campaign and to party committees, but to a super PAC, a Democratic super PAC, that then put money into Menendez's reelection campaign. And what was so fascinating about this episode is I think it showed that donors see super PACs as a way to curry favor with elected officials. In this case, the super PAC did not even appear to be aware that there was this arrangement between, alleged relation, arrangement between the donor and the senator, but they were sort of used as a pass-through for the donor to curry favor and support the senator, and allegedly in exchange for favors and efforts to help his businesses before the federal government.
And I think it should be clear from both from that episode and other episodes that we've seen, not, even those not involving any sort of criminal or allegation of criminal activity, is that once opened, you know, at the presidential level, this isn't going to stay at the presidential level. I mean, certainly money is useful to politicians at lots of levels. And we've even saw, like, in the midterm elections in 2014, where super PACs would be essentially operating, not just doing ads, but also doing, like, field work, canvassing, paying for people to do, you know, voter turnout. The Next Gen Climate Action Committee, funded almost entirely by billionaire Tom Steyer, they recently purchased the donor and volunteer list of Bruce Braley, who was an Iowa Senate candidate last year. They now have the best list of Democrats in Iowa. So they're not going to use that for ads. They're going to use that for voter turnout work.
Derek Willis, he's a reporter for The Upshot. That's the New York Times politics and policies site. Short break here. Your calls, your email when we come back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples, offering tools to promote business, including business cards, brochures, banners, and custom-branded items like pens, magnets, calendars, and foam fingers. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. And from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in the novel Some Luck, Jane Smiley introduced readers to the Langdons, a Depression-era Iowa farm family. Now the Pulitzer Prize winner follows their story through the Cold War, Vietnam, and the turbulent 60s. Jane Smiley on her new novel, Early Warning, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As we talk about super PACs and their growing influence, the laxity of regulation, let's go first to Jim in Hyattsville, Maryland. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, what do we as people and citizens of the United States get out of all this explosion of political activity? We're seeing a year and a half of campaigning. We're seeing possibly $1 trillion across the entire country diverted through this system, diversion of resources. We do get corruption of politics and government out of the process. And we get garbage advertisements. My inbox is filled with $3, $5, $15 solicitations from candidates all over the country. What do we get out of this process? And I think it's just a terrible trend.
Jan Behr.
Well, I know there's a lot of money, but it doesn't nearly approach $1 trillion. I mean, just to put
not
things in
yet.
Perspective.
Not yet.
Well, it would take quite a bit. All the money spent in 2012, the presidential year, was just a little bit over $7 billion. That's with a B. You know, to get $1 trillion, you're going to have to try really hard. I mean, Congress is capable of spending $1 trillion, but I don't think that candidates over a two-year period are able to.
Okay, but back to his question. What does the public get out of all this?
Well, they get the information that they need to make a decision about candidates and policies when it comes time to vote.
But let me read to you an email. What aggravates politically active people of both parties, in my view, says Diana, is the use made of these super PACs to create and air negative, misleading, and sometimes false information about opponents. Address that, Matea.
Well, I think what we're seeing are signs of a voter backlash against a lot of this money and how it's being spent. And probably the strongest evidence of that is the fact that the 2016 candidates have started actually talking about this on the campaign trail. Now, folks who want to reform the system really have not had much success turning this issue into something that mobilizes voters at the ballot box. And it remains to be seen whether they can in this election. But there's no question that this is something that's on the minds of a lot of people. When you talk to them about the Supreme Court, one of the first decisions they bring up is Citizens United. It's something that has penetrated the public consciousness in a way that a lot of other decisions haven't. And, we've seen now Hillary Clinton is making campaign finance reform one of the four planks of her campaign. I mean, this is also an effort by her to kind of strike a populist tone, win over voters in states like New Hampshire, where campaign finance reform has often been an important issue. But Republicans are talking about it as well. So there's clearly a building sentiment among voters that they feel that something is off
but
here.
But do you think the fact that Hillary raised this as part of her platform is an indication she's not going to use these super PACs?
Of course not. And in fact, there is a super PAC right now gathering $1 million donations to help her. She has decided to take lobbyist and PAC money for her campaign, unlike President Obama. So the argument the Democrats make is that they have to fight fire with fire and they can't go into this battle without the same kind of weapons as the Republicans. But it does make it harder to make the case that she's going to be the agent for change.
All right. Let's go to Manchester, New Hampshire. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, very nice talking to you, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
It's so fair. The things that bother me the most is that accountability. There were super PACs that were inferring corruption by our Senator Shaheen, who everybody knows in New Hampshire. That's why she won. But why isn't there any accountability? Why can't somebody go after the people that say these things that we know are lies and get some recourse?
Well, we have libel laws that protect public figures, and it's almost impossible to make a case of libel. There have been attempts to go after people for telling outright lies, and these cases don't succeed because the people they're talking about are public figures. And there's just no good answer to what good this does for the average American voter.
Yeah.
There are some state laws that have attempted to make it illegal or a crime for politicians to, quote, lie. The problem there is that the Supreme Court and other courts strike them down as violating the First Amendment and saying that you can't have the state regulate the content of political debate. The answer to falsehoods and misinformation is more information that rebuts all that.
And that's the answer. So if somebody says something on the campaign trail or an ad says something that implies a total negative and is on the edge, what you're saying is all you can do is bring out more information, Derek.
Well, and we also rely on a very vibrant press. Washington Post gets hammered.
Which gets hammered.
Well, always hammers and gives them Pinocchio noses and things like that when they're saying falsehoods.
But I think also this is one reason why there are at least two super PACs, one on the left and one on the right, that are dedicated to opposition research and essentially promoting or responding to partisan attacks or, you know, statements or ads or things like that. And they are now sort of a, you know, there's serious money behind these groups, which tells me that it's a serious concern, at least of the partisan sides, to be able to respond very quickly to attacks that come out from their opponents.
All right. Let's go now to Mansfield, Ohio. Hi there, Nick.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
The super PACs, as far as I can see, are just catching up with union strategies that the union has been using for years. They coordinate, they run phone banks. At least the people who give money to super PACs actually support the candidate that they're giving money to, whereas unions, a lot of the members don't even support the candidates or the causes that some of these that the union bosses support.
Kenneth Gross, fair statement.
It's illegal for a union to give any money to a candidate and has been since the 1940s. What the unions can do legally and have done is to call their members and get their members out to vote. That's the extent of it. And they certainly can fairly do that as any organization, whether it's the National Rifle Association or other membership organization.
Jan.
They also can spend money on advertisements of their own. They can give donations to super PACs and other groups that are politically active. So significant amounts of union money can be spent. It's legal. In many respects, it's constitutionally protected, just as corporate money is protected.
I want to, and I think you made some reference to this earlier, Ken Gross, ask you about dark money. Yes. What do we mean by dark money?
Dark money is money that's given to a 501c4 nonprofit organizations where the donors are simply not disclosed. The expenditures are often disclosed depending on how the money is disclosed, but we do not know the source of that money. And that's what has been characterized as dark money, and it's playing some of the same roles that super PACs are playing now.
So you've got both super PACs where donors are disclosed, and dark money, big money, where donors
there's
are
no
not
limit.
Disclosed.
There's no limit on this money, and next to super PAC, dark money starts to make super PACs look good when you deal with undisclosed contributions, because at least with super PACs, we know where the money's coming from.
Medea.
What's interesting about these nonprofit vehicles is they cannot engage in as robust political activity as a super PAC. They can't spend all of their money on political activity. Technically, it's supposed to not be their primary purpose, which has been interpreted to be
supposed to be 50%
less than
social good.
49% can be politically. That's sort of been the interpretation.
But who's regulating?
Right.
Who's watching?
So one of the things that this is has gotten caught up in is the IRS scandal that exploded a couple of years ago. In the wake of the Citizens United decision, the IRS began getting flooded with applications for C4 organizations and C5, which are business legs. And the agency was found to have been using inappropriate criteria to flag different organizations for extra scrutiny. So that essentially paralyzed the agency from doing a lot of this work. There's now an effort to revamp the rules for 501Cs, which is really progressing very slowly. In the meantime, many of these organizations are some of the most robust political organs that we have in our country, and probably the best example of that is the Koch Political Network. So Charles and David Koch and other conservative donors support a network of advocacy groups that do not disclose their donors. They have made it clear that they plan to engage in the Republican primaries by supporting several of the candidates, whether through issue ads, which don't expressly declare their support to say to vote for or vote against, or also express ads that say, yes, we think you should cast the ballot for this person. And those groups are really part of the fabric of campaigns now.
Now, are those ads where we most clearly see the shading of the truth, Derek?
They can be. But to be fair, I think the super PACs have, like, what they have going for them in terms of is utility, is the sort of maximum utility. They can say what they like, essentially, and they don't have to worry about the sort of shadow of, or as much about the shadow of regulators looking over the content of the message. With the nonprofits, I think the advantage there is most of the advantage is for the donor's benefit, frankly, because it is like you can give money without it being disclosed. It does, you're a little bit limited, excuse me, in some circumstances of what you can say and when you know, what words you can use and things like that. So I think the C4s are certainly a fairly powerful weapon. And as Matteo and others have said, this is not a new thing. I mean, you know, this is, you know, the Sierra Club, organizations like that have been C4s for a long, long time. And this is simply another sort of tool in the arsenal of political campaigning.
All right, to Sharon in Dallas, Texas, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I like so many others today, believe that the amount of money in politics is disturbing. It completely drowns out the voice of the people. So I would like to ask your panel if they think that there are actual chances of overturning Citizens United one day and returning the power to the people. Thank you.
Kenneth Gross.
Well, the Citizens United decision hangs on the vote of one individual. As I mentioned before, it shifted when Sandra Day O'Connor left the court. If one of the five so-called conservative justices leaves the court and we have a president that will replace them with a more moderate or liberal, however you want to characterize it, not conservative justice, and a case comes before them, this could get reversed. The chances of there being a constitutional amendment, which would be required to trump the Supreme Court, I think are next to zero. So I think our hope would only be in a reconfiguration of the Supreme Court.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you think or see a rising tide of protest about Citizens United that indeed could lead to another hearing on this case?
It could. It could. I mean, I'm not ready to go out and get my own gyrocopter and land it on the Capitol Hill steps. But historically, raising campaign finance as a campaign issue has not worked. The voters don't seem to have responded to it and say, well, we're going to vote for this guy because he's supporting strong campaign finance laws. But that may be changing. This has become so bad and so big that perhaps maybe it will start to resonate among the electorate.
And let's take a caller here in Washington, D.C. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
So there's been a lot of talk of the negative or perceived negative impacts of super PACs. I am a resident of the District of Columbia, and we don't have voting rights here in the district. So I started my own super PAC, Not Your District, Political Action Committee, and we're raising money to sort of raise the issue of statehood. I would wonder if your guests have any opinions on maybe there are ways for citizens to actually use super PACs to our advantage?
Derek.
So this is interesting because one of the flip side, obviously, of being able to, you know, create organizations that are dependent only on a few donors, wealthy donors, is that you could do this in an effort to fight, sort of fight the system, as it were. Now, it's a difficult thing to do, to be sure. But there are examples of donors banding together and even raising fairly significant sums of money to try to either make campaign finance reform or another like single issue to put that higher on the congressional agenda or to elect people to support or defeat a certain piece of legislation. But I think that there also are sort of experiments within elections where try to sort of change the incentives for candidates through applying large amounts of money via a super PAC in order to try to affect candidate behavior. These are small and they're early, but we saw a couple of them in the 2014 midterm elections. Most of them would not be described as successes in any real way, but that's sort of how experimentation goes at first. And I think that there is the possibility that if this is the system that we have or are going to have for a while, that there will be more experiments that will bring more sort of being able to bring to bear either large sums of money through small numbers of donors or large sums of money through lots of donors into the system to be able to kind of force an issue or a position onto the agenda.
Matea.
Just to go back quickly to the question about whether this dynamic could change, I do think we should also consider the possibility that the legal framework could go in the other direction, which means even more money coming into the system directly to candidates and parties. And Jan is not the only Republican talking about how this constrains candidates unfairly. Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, and several other candidates are talking about how there needs to be more money that go directly to the candidates themselves. And there's definitely a legal and intellectual push on the right to try to loosen campaign finance restrictions for candidates.
How would you feel about that, Ken Gross, very quickly?
I don't think the House of Cards needs to fall in order to accommodate higher limits. The truth is very few people are actually giving the limit, but I wouldn't be adverse to raising contribution limits to candidates as long as it was a reasonable amount of money.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Ken Gross, Jan Barron, Derek Willis, Matea Gold, thank you all so much. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Reed.